Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of June. Hour number two of our program, the story of how same-sex marriage became legal in New York. The New York Times had a very interesting front-page story just about this issue on Sunday of this week, and it says it's about shifting public sentiment and individual lawmakers moved by emotional appeals from gay couples who wish to be wed. Behind the scenes, it's really about a Republican Party reckoning with a profoundly changing power dynamic where Wall Street donors and gay rights advocates demonstrated more might and muscle than a Roman Catholic hierarchy and an ineffective opposition. We'll have two guests with us the first hour of our program, a reporter who covers New York State politics and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times, and later with a clinical professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. Hour number two of our program today. I had a good time last night reading a good chunk of Bill Moyer's new book, which is conversations with people he had on the Journal. And it's interesting how so many of the themes are still with us. There must be 47, 48 interviews, and they're all substantive interviews with poets, with people who are trying to effect change, with conservative legislators, with former speechwriters for Barry Goldwater. Jeremy Scahill is in the book, Nikki Giovanni. So Bill Moyers will be with us, hour number two. Both hours, you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. Our first guest, Nick Confessori, who's a reporter who covers New York State politics and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times. And Nick, thank you very much for being with us.
Morning. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great.
Good. This is a big story. Let's start with Governor Cuomo, who the piece on Sunday talks about the speech that he gave to Republicans at the governor's residence, you know, which was poetic, as his father is poetic, which was strong. How did he take this issue on, and why did he take this issue on? Why is it near and dear to him?
I think for a few reasons. One, I think he saw the chance for victory on an issue that's important to his party and important to people. And two, I think that if you talk to him, talk to his friends and family, he began to feel that this was a way for him to show that he was more than just a budget cutter. His first few months in office were really dominated by fiscal issues, getting New York's fiscal house in order, and he governed like a Republican in a lot of ways. Cutting spending on schools and health care. He was fending off calls from within his own party for tax hikes on the rich to help offset those cuts. He was passing an ethics bill, which I think is a bipartisan issue. But those were all, you know, not the kind of things that really make your heart sing. And I think, you know, he wanted to show that he was more than just that guy, that he could be a moral leader for people's rights, So, in March, he held a meeting of same-sex marriage advocates in the second floor of the Capitol, where he has his office. And he said, "I care about this. I'm committing to you that I'm going to get it done, and I'm going to do it." And he did. And he was also moved, I think, as many were, by friends and family. His partner, Sandra Lee, has a gay brother, and we know that she was urging him to really, you know, push it and make it happen. And it really is, you know, like so many other lawmakers who changed their position on this, the change is really driven not so much by the, you know, direct mail and the TV advertisements, or even necessarily by the constituent letters, although, you know, kind of obviously it's very important. It's really people in their own lives, you know, in their own family, friends, people in their communities who came up to them and said, "Look, Senator, Governor, please work on this issue because it matters to me."
So all of a sudden we have a number of people of whatever political persuasion who realize that there are gay family members and they're going to go to bat for them?
That's right. I think, you know, each of these senators, especially the Republicans who changed their votes this year, or the Republicans who voted for the first time on this issue but voted for it, you know, all have a story like that of someone coming to them and saying, "I'm trying to marry my partner of 30 years, but I can't. You know, my son is gay." You know, all of them have that story.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. The article outlined how the message was given in a very, the whole orchestration of the message, that all the groups had to get together, that it sounds like the governor's office really orchestrated how the message was delivered. And if you went off track with this, you were going to get a call.
Yeah, you know, Governor Cuomo is nothing if not a bit of a control freak. And when he's in charge of something, he's in charge of all of it. Now, you know, kind of that said, one of the reasons this failed in 2009 in New York was that the advocacy community was horribly disorganized. And frankly, you know, we're much more interested in getting credit for something that hadn't been accomplished yet than, or rather, I shouldn't say that they were more interested in that, but you know, the desire, the jockeying for credit, for position, for leadership on something that hadn't really even been done was pretty intense. And I think they all recognized that this year, to their credit, as advocates, and they went to the governor for help. And the governor said, "My job here is going to be to coordinate and manage this process and strategize." And so everybody was pretty much on the team, said what he told them to say, hired an advisor of his as their consultant. He also deployed his top aide, the secretary to the governor, it's the senior most job in government, to personally supervise this, to handle the advocacy and the lobbying of the individual lawmakers. He was really the guy who put it all together. And then ultimately, I think it was his pleas to these guys, you know, on a political level, where he would say to them, to these senators, "You know, I can be more of an asset to you if you do this than the people who are going to hit you for it will be an obstacle to you." Because he's a very popular governor. He's in the 70s in some polls. He's trusted by voters. And so his endorsement of this, his championing of it, was really pivotal.
What about the opposition from the Catholic Church? Archbishop Dolan, who was our archbishop for some years, sort of led in opposition, at least from what I've read in the New York Times. Was it just not vigorous enough?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, the National Organization for Marriage, which is a group that opposes same-sex marriages, they certainly put some money into the state, over $1 million, if the estimates are accurate, and did letters and phone calls as well. I think the Catholic Church, their advocacy is a little, you know, more restrained in general. They don't do the full-on grassroots programs in the same way, for the most part. You know, really, it's the moral voice of the church. It's speaking publicly. That is how they seek to sway policy. But you know, it did seem like the opposition this year was not as vigorous as the proponents, nor as coordinated or as well-financed. I mean, what you have to remember is one of the real shifts this year was that most, if not, you know, the bulk of the financing for the lobbying campaign, the TV ads, the radio ads in favor of same-sex marriage, was underwritten by donors who typically support Republicans. These are hedge fund guys on Wall Street.
Isn't that something?
Who are conservative in their politics, but really more in a libertarian bent, which is a minority in their party. But they saw this as an issue of personal liberty. Some of them had gay relatives or children, and so they had a personal attachment to the issue. And so their money, you know, if you think about it, for Republicans in New York State, which you know, it's a diverse state, but overall not that conservative, obviously. You know, to have these guys say, "Look, we are a constituency in your party, a donor class in your party that is going to be with you on this issue." And these are people, for the most part, who don't play in state politics very much, you know, kind of don't give money in state races. And they said, "Look, if if you do this, we're going to be there to help you.
Yeah, we've got your back, but how will they have their back? Will they be pouring money into races?
Yeah, I mean, you have to imagine it's going to be money. It's going to be fundraising and fundraisers and donations. And, you know, theoretically, you can imagine some of these guys forming a pack or, you know, an independent expenditure group to run ads supporting these guys. You know, there are all kinds of ways you can help somebody if you're willing to not coordinate directly with them in a campaign.
Tell me about those TV and radio ads. We, of course, didn't see them in Wisconsin.
You know, they kind of ran the gamut. One set of ads that I think was mostly on the web, actually, was, you know, a long series of celebrities, you know, a few business leaders, sports people. You know, it's hard to evaluate the effectiveness of that. If I'm a Republican state senator, I'm not sure that being told by Anna Wintour that I should vote for gay marriage is going to be a real push. But Sean Avery, the hockey player, you know, comes out and says he's for gay marriage, and it makes the sports pages. You know, it reaches
right.
A different kind of person. And aside from that, it was just an appeal, you know, based on fairness, on families, and the position of the advocates that it was the right thing to do.
My husband is a baseball announcer who's in New York right now, and he's a columnist. He was saying that one of the Mets announcers at the beginning of the game on Saturday or Sunday made long mention of this and how wonderful it was, and he was struck by that coming from a baseball announcer.
That's right.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. Here's our number. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The story of how same-sex marriage became legal in New York. It is the sixth and, of course, by far the largest state to legalize same-sex marriage. Nick Confessori is a reporter who covers New York state politics and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times. We're referencing a front-page story they did on Sunday. He, of course, has been covering this story for some time, for some years probably, on how this happened. It's a fascinating story. And we welcome your phone calls. Email is talk@WPR.org. We start our calls with George in Egg Harbor. Hi, George. George.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I was wondering how involved was the Mormon Church in the passage or trying to defeat the passage of this law. I saw a documentary on California on the Prop 8, and apparently from what they said, the Mormon Church, millions of dollars went from the Mormon Church through, or the people of the Mormon Church through the Catholic organization to defeat, you know, the passage of that in California. I was just wondering what happened to that powerful machine this time.
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the National Organization for Marriage has often gotten financial support from Mormon donors, and they played a real role in California. So I imagine that there was some money, you know, that ultimately came out of their coffers for the ads they ran in New York State. You know, part of the reason I think that we didn't see the same full-fledged opposition this time was because of a very deliberate effort by the governor and the advocates to rope-a-dope them. And, you know, it's politics, it's how things work, but, you know, the bills were not even introduced into the legislature until very late in the game, and in fact, the state assemblyman who has championed the bill in his house for a couple of years, who has passed it in the assembly for a couple of years, his name is Daniel J. O'Donnell. He got impatient. He got sick of waiting for the governor to do it, and he introduced his own bill a few weeks before the end of the session, and he got rebuked by the governor's top aide privately. That's also in our story, who said, you know, what the heck are you doing? You're kind of messing up our strategy, because the whole point was to not do anything until they thought they could do everything and to kind of bum rush the opposition. Oh. Saw that in the last 2 weeks of the session, or the last week of the actual session and then the week of overtime. You know, there was a real push on Monday. they brought out the three remaining Democrats in the Senate who were thought to be possible votes, had them announce. Then they rolled out the first Republican to break ranks, and then a second Republican from the Capital area up near Albany got so sick of being badgered by reporters in the hallways that he kind of just announced it on the fly.
Oh my!
In a press scrum, and then all of a sudden, two Senate Republicans had broken ranks, and it was one vote short of passage, and it began to be much, much harder for the Senate to make a decision to bottle it up without bringing it to the floor, which was always a possibility. And that would have been the easiest thing for the Senate Republicans to do, to spare their marginal members a tough vote and to accede to the wishes of their own voters and their own party to not play a role in passing it.
Interesting. Well, I think there was also a lot of negative feedback to the Mormon Church on this, too. I mean, a lot of people saying, boy, if they're going to push this much money into a political issue like this, maybe they should be paying taxes. So, I mean, that's another factor that maybe was part of this.
Thanks, George, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. What about the factor of public sentiment? We hear polls now that show that a majority of Americans favor same-sex marriage. Were legislators in tune with that?
Well, it's important because, in New York State, you saw this, it kind of averages out to maybe 4% a year. You see this uptick. In fact, there's a fresh poll out today. The Quinnipiac poll shows 54%, I think it was, of New Yorkers in favor of gay marriage, with the usual kind of very stark age divide of people under 40 are much more strongly in favor of it. People over 40 are much more against it. But to sort of have public opinion behind your back, I mean, it does matter. It affects how lawmakers think about where the issue is and where they should be and where the world is. So as you see those numbers, go up, it does create kind of a swell upwards. But of course, what really matters is individual districts, constituents. A Democrat, Joe Addabbo from, a fairly moderate district in Queens, New York, said that he had basically counted up, he had tallied the letters and calls into his district office and gone the way that the tally had gone. Now, you could argue that that's not what lawmakers are actually supposed to do, but that's how some of them chose to do it. They said, we're taking ourselves out of the decision. We're going to just see who has the better ground game, who can put more calls into my office. And so ultimately, it is the constituents that they listen to.
And also, it was the strength in the organization of the same-sex marriage crowd. They knew how to send in those postcards.
That's right. I mean, I think it was in our story that when that one Senator Addabbo said, I'm going to listen to the calls and to the mail, the advocates pushed a button and flooded his office with mail and calls. Just flooded it. Thousands and thousands of letters and calls.
More phone calls in a moment. Nick Confessori is a reporter who covers New York State politics and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times. If you want to read a fascinating story about how same-sex marriage became legal in New York, read the Sunday front page story. It's fascinating, and he's here to give us details. Later this hour, we'll be speaking, actually pretty soon, with Suzanne Goldberg, clinical professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Moyers is with us the second hour of the program today. His journal interviews with about 47 or 8. I counted him yesterday and I can't remember. 47 or 48 people who you want to listen to is in his new book, The Conversation Continues. Bill is with us, hour number two of our show. Charlie in Superior, hi.
Hello, listening to the antics that went on in the legislature and what a close call it was there, it brings to mind the good question, will the people of New York overturn this with a constitutional amendment?
Well, so New York is not a state, as it turns out, where citizens can petition via ballot to overturn laws. So no initiative can go on the ballot unless the legislature agrees to put it there. So it seems unlikely that with the state assembly firmly in control of Democrats, and with the Republicans having just done this in the Senate, and with Governor Cuomo being the guy who pushed this in the first place, there's just no chance it's going to happen. Other states obviously have you know, the people in the states have the ability to bypass the legislature and put stuff on the ballot via signatures, but New York does not have that.
Rich in Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen and guests. I just wanted to say this battle has been won in a long war, but everyone who's a supporter of GLBTQ rights should know that in terms of benefits for gay people, certain things are not going to be granted, and they're on the national level. I do not believe that military pensions can be passed along now to gay people in New York. Certainly Social Security under our national law cannot. And a number of barriers have fallen, most notably Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think ex-military people are going to be gay people, and their supporters from the military are going to become even more powerful. This issue is going to loom extremely large in the 2012 election. I think this time, if the Republican Party tries to play it too much as a social issue, it's going to be extremely interesting to watch, because I think it's going to come back to bite them. Finally, I don't know if Andrew Cuomo is as good a speaker as Mario Cuomo. I don't care. I want him to run for president of the United States. Okay.
I think a lot of people do, Rich. There were signs in the parades over the weekend, weren't there?
That's Nick? Correct. Yeah, yeah. Huh. Some of the signs used a derogatory phrase that I won't repeat on the air, but tongue-in-cheekly to say that they were for Cuomo in 2016.
Huh. So he made a lot of people's hearts sing.
Yeah, the Pride Parade up in New York on Sunday was a real event for him, and he certainly got a hero's welcome.
How long do you think it'll be before other states follow suit? Is this a long, long process?
I think so. I wrote a story for Monday's paper about this. 29 states have amendments banning gay marriage. 12 more have laws on the books banning gay marriage. Or 12 states do, and some of them overlap. You know, some have both. It's like a belt and suspenders approach to banning gay marriage. Republicans who tend to be more opposed to this than Democrats control a majority of legislatures. I think they control a majority of the governorships as well. So it seems to me, and this is just a guess, but that the likely next stage in this is, you know, a couple of states that have Democratic lawmakers controlling the legislatures, Democratic governors that have been close in the past, like Maryland or Rhode Island, will do this legally. And then I think we're in for a longer wait at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a vocal plurality of Americans who strongly oppose gay marriage, and they have won, kind of almost every ballot initiative. You know, as your earlier caller, I think, was suggesting, there's only one time in the country, and this is in Arizona in 06, where a ballot amendment to outlaw gay marriage has been defeated once in the whole country. So you do see sentiment shifting in the polls, and that will eventually be reflected in the law and in political attitudes. But I think it's going to take a little longer.
Yes. Do you have time for two more people who would like to speak with
sure.
you? Okay. Tim in Ladysmith. Hi.
Hi. I'm adamantly opposed to gay marriage, I have to say, and I'm very disappointed in the Republicans. I'm a tend to vote Republican, and this is tends to be a problem with Republicans, is they don't seem to have a backbone when they really need to have a backbone. The predominant majority of Republicans oppose gay marriage. And I think this is a Pandora's box we've opened that's going to just, these states that continue to do this stuff, it's going to open the door to everything under the sun. And I know proponents of gay marriage say, no, no, no. But, you know, if you're going to have gay marriage in states like New York, then they need to repeal every polygamy law and every other law like that, because what's the difference? So, you know, I don't want to see anybody prosecuted for polygamy in New York if you're going to have gay marriage rights, because to me, it's they're equal, basically. So I think it's a sad day for America that we're allowing this to happen.
Nick?
Well, I'll leave it to everyone to have their own opinion on it. I'll keep mine to myself. I'm not really, you know, a legal expert, but it seems to me that if a majority of Americans comes to support gay marriage and the majority of Americans still opposes polygamy, you probably won't have too much of that problem. But I know it is an argument made by the opposition to this issue that it opens the door to other things, and I guess we'll see when we see.
So do you think that really, well, you mentioned that under 40, over 40, we'll have to wait for everybody under 40 to get older for this to be?
Well, it's really striking. You know, what you see is not just age, but across, you know, political lines, you know, kind of young conservative people, young Republicans are much more in support of this than older conservative people, older Republicans. It's really, I mean, it's a striking generational shift, probably because a lot of them have grown up in an era and a span of time when gay people and lesbians are out of the closet more, when they have friends in high school, in college who are gay, when gay people are part of the culture, are visible. And so I think what you hear when you talk to supporters of gay marriage about how they hope that New York will affect their longer-term push is that, look, this is a large state. It's a visible state. It's home to the economic and cultural capital of the country, New York City. And more importantly, when this law goes into effect, twice as many Americans will live in places where gay marriage is legal. And you're going to see a lot of gay married couples. I think what advocates are betting is that, you know, the more you see it, the less scary it seems, or the less objectionable it seems, and the more mundane it becomes. And at that point, that, I think, in their estimation, you know, that ultimately fuels the legal debate, the political debate, the social debate.
What is it, do you think, Nick, that keeps the president from endorsing this fully?
Well, I can't speculate about what's going on in his mind. He said his views are evolving. I don't really know what that means. You know, it seems to me it's not something that would take years to think of your position on, either way, pro or against. Right now he says he's against gay marriage and for civil unions. But you do have to wonder whether politics isn't really the real question here. If I were the president, I would not want to run for re-election in a down economy, being known as the guy who decided to come out for gay marriage now. It was a intensely potent issue for Republicans in 2004. It helped George Bush get re-elected. In fact, Republicans put a lot of ballot measures to ban gay marriage on ballots in swing states in
right.
part to bring out conservative voters who were opposed to gay marriage. I'm not sure that's a nut the president wants to crack, but on the other hand, I think you could argue, and some advocates do, that taking a risky stand, also wins you support in a different way,
mm-hmm.
and demonstrates, you know, a different set of qualities. And I guess we'll see what he decides in the coming months.
Mm-hmm. And one more call, Linda in Spruceville. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Yes, first of all, I'm in favor of allowing gay people to marry, and I don't believe that's going to be leading to polygamy or anything else. It just seems ridiculous to me. It's one of those arguments that the religious right likes to throw out there, you know, just to fend off the whole issue. But my main thought is that when they start, the Catholic Church or the Mormons or anybody else starts trying to pressure politicians by saying that they're not going to give them communion or anything else along those lines, seems to me to be a strict affront to separation of church and state. Churches are not supposed to be political, and they should lose their tax-exempt status if they're going to be saying such things openly. I just think it's ridiculous.
Well, you know, it's usually considered the right of private institutions, including churches and synagogues and religious institutions, to set the conditions of their own membership, and it remains true in New York. You know, politics. What the tax exemption says is that you can't engage in political advocacy. You can't run ads. You can't endorse. You can't back certain candidates. But I think that's probably a pretty far leap away from simply saying if you're not going to adhere, especially for Catholics, if you're not going to adhere to the teachings of the Church, we can't in good conscience give you communion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda, very much for the call. Nick, thank you. What a fascinating story to be covering, I'm sure, as well, on so many levels.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Nick. Nick Confessori, reporter who covers New York State politics and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times, who contributed to the article that we were mentioning, although he's been covering this story for quite some time. Sunday issue of the New York Times, How Same-Sex Marriage Became Legal in New York. What does all this mean legally? We're going to be switching guests at this point. Suzanne Goldberg is a clinical professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School. Her areas of expertise are sexuality and gender law, civil procedure, civil rights, equality theory, and more. She has been a member of the New Jersey Civil Practice Committee of the New Jersey Supreme Court, the Georgetown Journal of Gender and the Law Annual Review Board of Advisors. And she is with us now to talk about the legality of all of this. And we'll welcome more of your phone calls. So if you want to join the conversation, feel free to do so. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor Suzanne Goldberg, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Well, this was quite a thing that happened in New York. We were just talking with Nick Confessori, who covers this for the New York Times, and I thought their Sunday article was so fascinating about how this was achieved, wasn't it?
Yes, very interesting.
Yeah, everything had to be just so. What does it mean for the rest of the country for this, the sixth and by far the largest state in the country, to legalize same-sex marriage?
It means a great deal politically, legally, and otherwise. Politically, New York's decision to grant equal marriage rights to same-sex couples will reverberate around the nation, and it already has started. And I think the reverberations are felt in a couple of places. I mean, certainly this is providing great momentum to activists and advocates who are seeking equal marriage rights for gay couples. But it also adds pressure to political actors in states around the country because this was hard-fought and because some of the Republicans in New York recognized that marriage equality is a bipartisan issue, right? It's not just a Democrat issue. And with that, I think there's more pressure on Republicans as well as some groundwork laid for people to change their minds, people who have voted against marriage equality before.
It's hard to imagine certain states, which are very red states right now, taking up this issue.
You know, one of the interesting things is, I mean, of course, there's all the data that suggests that the divisions between red and blue appear to be stronger than they actually are. But one of the other key points in this issue is that sexual orientation or being gay isn't limited to Democrats, right?
Right.
So there are plenty
right.
of gay Republicans and plenty of Republicans with a lot of power who have gay people in their families and among their friends and who are recognizing that it is just simply not fair for
the, you know, their gay friends and family to be to face different and limit more limited relationship recognition rules than they have. And in fact, one of the interesting points in New York was that, you know, critical to changing two of the previous no votes to yes votes for marriage equality were that both of those elected officials had gay members in their gay family members, and realized, you know, I can't continue to vote no, and that's likewise critical for some of the donors as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the parts of this law that allow those who are not in favor of same-sex marriage to actually do the officiating. Are there caveats for people in certain religious groups?
Right. So the law provides a broad exemption for people affiliated for religiously based organizations and those working for them or professionally affiliated with them to continue to discriminate against gay couples in marriage consistent with their religious tenets. So, you know, a priest would not have to marry a gay couple, for example. And that's always the case, even if there is no exemption written into the law, but the exemption has made some members of the New York legislature and some members of religious groups feel more secure. Right? So a church does not have to rent out its facilities or offer its facilities to marry a same-sex couple, and that's as it should be. Right? Religious groups should be and are constitutionally protected in their freedom to follow their religious tenets, including mm-hmm. you know, not to allow gay people to marry or not to allow anybody else to marry should they choose.
Mm-hmm. And does this do anything to, we had a Facebook message on this, domestic partnerships? If you choose not to get married, does it put domestic partnerships at risk?
All right, so that's an interesting question as well. New York has not had a statewide domestic partnership or civil union law. So up to this point, New Yorkers who wanted to register their relationships could do that at a city level in some jurisdictions or in another state, but not in New York. One of the questions, and lots of employers have provided benefits, family benefits to employees who have domestic partners. One of the questions going forward will be whether those employers now say, well, you have to get married in order to get
right.
health insurance for your partner. That doesn't seem to me to be the right result. And I know in some other jurisdictions where they've had marriage already, in Massachusetts, in Washington, D.C., for example, some employers have told all their employees, you have to get married. Others have said, no, you can actually be in a domestic partnership or be married. The point from the employer's perspective is that they will give the benefits if the employees hold themselves out as in a committed family relationship.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, throughout the country, how often does this kind of same-sex couples the right to marry come? How often does it come from a legislative decision, from a legal decision? Is it all over the board here?
It's mixed, actually. So Massachusetts was the first state to grant marriage equality to gay couples, and that was a court decision. But after that, we saw legislatively votes in Vermont and New Hampshire. The court acted in Iowa, and the legislature acted in Washington, D.C. So it's actually been quite a mix. And, of course, in California, we saw a mix of judicial and legislative action, and that is continuing to go on. And I suspect that that is what we'll see going forward, where there will be pressure wherever, you know, which is true in most states, where there is not marriage equality for same and different sex couples. Advocates will press both in the legislatures and in the courts with essentially the same claim, which is that it's simply not fair to constituents to treat some committed couples differently from others vis-a-vis the state.
How important was it to have someone like Governor Cuomo, who comes from a long line of pretty poetic talkers and persuaders, to have him champion this issue and be on it pretty doggedly and organize it and really push it through?
So I want to give you two answers to that, both very important and important but not everything. So very important. I mean, clearly having the top elected official in the state take up the marriage equality issue and push it eloquently, as you noted, is terrifically important. It's important for the vision. It's important because he was willing to give political capital to say, I will be there for you on other issues. You need to be here for me on this one. And in some ways, nothing is better than that. At the same time, all of that effort came on top of a groundwork that had been laid over the course of years, really, by activists and lawyers and other advocates who had been working with state legislators, first to introduce them to the idea of gay people, then to get an anti-discrimination law passed, and then to move people forward so that the ground was, in a sense, fertile when the governor came in, and then he took marriage equality over the finish line.
And can you explain to me, Nick was talking about how the percentage of people who are in favor of same-sex marriage in this country seems to go up by 4% year by year. What's going on with that?
A couple things are going on with that. I think one, fundamentally, people are seeing their gay neighbors and family members and friends get married, sometimes in their own state, sometimes in others, and the sky is not falling, as a colleague of mine is fond of saying, right? So married gay couples work alongside married heterosexual couples, and all seems to be fine. You know, a second piece of the polling data is the demographic skew, and what we see consistently is that for young people, being gay is just a benign difference, right? It's not particularly interesting. It's benign. Sexual orientation differences are seen as benign variation among people. And that shift is very important. I think a lot of young people are sort of puzzled and scratching their heads, like, why is this such a big issue? Why are we having to fight about marriage for gay people or gay people serving in the military? Let's, you know, all move ahead. We have bigger issues to deal with, you know, the economy and war, for instance. But sexual orientation discrimination just is not something that young people seem to be committed to.
Professor Suzanne Goldberg, clinical professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School, is our guest now. We're talking about same-sex marriage and how New York has become the sixth and the largest state in the country, of course, to legalize same-sex marriage. What does that mean for the rest of the country? What does it mean for New York? Here's our phone number. We have time for a few more phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, should you care to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, Bill Moyers will be with us. His journal, The Conversation Continues, has just been published and consists of a series of really wonderful interviews and thoughtful and deep interviews with some 47, 48 people, including Jane Goodall and Jeremy Scahill, who's from Wisconsin. Many, many others will be happy to have Bill Moyers with us, hour number two. Two phone calls now. Dan in Three Lakes, Iowa is next.
Good morning.
Hi.
Over the last two or three years, I spent quite a bit of time in Iowa. And just the history of the situation in Iowa was same-sex marriage was legalized by the Iowa Supreme Court. And Iowa had probably what was thought to be one of the best judicial selection processes in the country, in that a commission was lined up to made up of lawyers and citizens and so forth to recommend to the governor appointees to the Supreme Court, who after a time had to run in a retention election, but not against an opponent. Well, the Iowa Supreme Court issued its opinion, unanimous opinion, in favor of gay marriage and recognizing that it violated the state and federal protections against equal constitutions, protections against equal protection of the laws. And then, and prior to the 2010 election, an individual businessman from northwestern Iowa announced that he was going to run in the Republican primary on the specific issue of gay marriage, and if elected governor, he was going to issue an executive order overturning the Supreme Court. He made that announcement. although that's not possible. In any event, the Republican Party nationally gave him $1 million to not run in the Republican primary for governor and financed him in an election campaign to recall from the Supreme Court the three justices that were eligible for non-retention election that particular year. All of them were bumped off the court. Their replacements have not been established yet. But that is how the issue came down in Iowa, and they are now in Iowa moving toward a constitutional amendment outlawing gay marriage, following along the lines of the federal law, Marriage Act. And the judge, the lower court judge in Iowa, who issued the original opinion that was upheld by the Iowa Supreme Court, was up for a retention election at the same time, and he was retained.
Professor Goldberg.
So what you're pointing to are two important issues, right, or many important issues, but two of them are, first, that this continues to be a battle, right? I often think of us as a country as being in our adolescence where, you know, we are growing up, we are coming to accept equality, but there's, a strong impulse to kick and scream along the, and door slam along the way. And I think a lot of the effort in Iowa could be understood as this raging against the maturing of a society toward equality. The second is that there is a lot of money in this battle, and particularly a lot of money on the side of those who would oppose marriage equality. Not that there's not money on the pro-equality side, but those against marriage equality for gay couple have enormous funding and are typically outspending the marriage equality folks quite substantially, and as you've just mentioned, including with support directly from the Republican Party.
And where else is that money coming from?
The money is coming from religiously based organizations significantly. I mean, something that was noted in connection with Proposition 8 in California, which banned marriage for same-sex couples after the court had ordered it, the California Supreme Court had ordered it, was that substantial funds actually came from out of state, from the Mormon community. But it's, you know, certainly not just Mormons. It's many, many conservative religious organizations that are funding this heavily.
Thank you, Jan, so much for your call. It was interesting. Janice in La Crosse, hi.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen and your guest. I'm actually appalled. I'm mortified. I'm everything. I'm just devastated, basically. I'm Catholic, and, you know, I am all for civil unions, if that's fine. Don't ever call it a same-sex marriage over my dead body. I will absolutely, I'd go to jail. I'd probably die for it, because I think, you know, it's sacred. It's between one man and one woman, or none of us would be here. That's my definition of marriage. And then children. Nobody talks about children, because, you know, the ramifications of that will be something else. If AIDS ever raises its ugly head up later down the line, it won't be so great either then. And I feel God's going to get the final word. I mean, Como's Catholic. I can't believe, not a practicing Catholic. And, you know, love everybody, but he will not redefine marriage for me. Between one man and one woman, I'll just go to jail, go to death for it. Believe it. I believe
okay.
In it. I'll stand up.
I believe you feel pretty strongly about this. Professor Goldberg.
Yeah, and I and many people would defend your right to feel very strongly about it. The question here isn't redefining marriage from a religious standpoint. And as we were talking about earlier, religions can and should absolutely maintain their view of what is sacred. The job of the state is not to establish the sacred. The job of the state is to allocate rights and responsibilities. And civil marriage is really, when we look at what the state does by allowing people to get married, is it's creating a kind of ordering for society. And it's mainly for the purpose of rights and responsibilities. So people can be married in the state, but not married in the church, or vice versa. But the state is not in the business of defining the sacred.
Thanks for the call. And Professor Goldberg, thank you so much for your time.
Happy to be here.
Our guest this half hour, Professor Suzanne Goldberg. She's clinical professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. We also thank Columbia Law School, Nick Confessori, who joined us earlier from the New York Times. He's a reporter who covers New York state politics, which has been an interesting beat, I'm sure, for some time, and government for the Metropolitan Desk of the New York Times. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with Bill Moyers. So please join us for hour number two. We're going to have lots of conversation about lots of his conversations. So don't go away. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.